Brilliant. Well, without further ado, I'm going to hand across to our last keynote of the day, which is Pete Reeve, who is down from Auckland for the day. He's the founder and CEO of LaunchSight, which is a company that specializes in virtual reality. And also, Pete gets to work in Second Life a lot. He works with consulting for businesses, Auckland City Council, etc. Chairman of Film Auckland, so he's also very much up on the moving images, and is currently studying knowledge transfer and creative collaboration in Second Life. And one of the coolest things is he's teaching the very first New Zealand class in Second Life. So, hey, you can even go to university online now. So I'm going to hand over to Pete.
Thanks, Helen. I just want to get a feel for who you are. And I wondered, who would classify themselves as a sort of science, logical, engineering type? Hands up. Okay. And who would classify themselves as a creative type? And where did those who didn't put their hand up fit in? Okay. So the interesting thing is a guy called Daniel Pink wrote a book called The Whole New Mind. And there's been a, you probably know this, they talk about left hemisphere, right hemisphere. Are you a left brain thinker or a right brain thinker? Well, the news is you've got to be both. The challenge for the future is we're going into a very disruptive world. When I started out, I'm going to take you on a little trip. It's let's call it a time travel. I'm from the past, as you can tell. I'm also in the present, and we're all going into the future together. Now, back in 1966, they made this fantastic movie called Fantastic Voyage. Let me just show you a little. This starred Donald Pleasance, Raquel Welch, and a number of others. Now, this unbelievable movie shrunk these scientists down in a submarine, made them tiny, and then they went inside. It was during the Cold War, and so they went inside. Their mission, should they choose to accept it, was to go inside this guy's body and to get the Reds who were there to kill this guy. So unbelievable as this might seem, we're now entering a phase in technology. Don't think we're going to shrink you down to miniature size, but nanotechnology. Have you all heard of nanotechnology? Hands up, who have? Okay, great. So back in 2000, when I first started talking to people about nanotechnology, they all thought I was mad. When Drexler wrote the book Engines of Creation in 88, they all thought he was certifiable. We're now at a stage where it's going to become real. Well, it is real. Here we are going through the bloodstream. Well, this is what they're already working on. We're going to be able to cure cancer by basically injecting drugs that will deliver, will inject nanobots that will deliver drugs directly into the cells. Let me jump. Everyone's talked a little bit about their background. Where I've come from, I've always wanted to make films. When I was about 10 years old, I had a Super 8 and made films. I made a little box to do what they call onion skinning, which is classic old animation term where you've seen it where you flick through papers, where you go backwards and forwards and draw over it. Of course, the technology has come a long way. I ended up going through university because there wasn't a film school around. Elam sort of had one, but I ended up in the politics department, would you believe, because they had a postgraduate diploma in broadcasting. So that's as close as I could get at the time. Then I went overseas. I worked in the film industry for 4 years in Australia, came back, worked for TVNZ when TV3 was starting up, and then moved to Comunicado, which is now known as Screen Time. Then started up my own company called The Original Cut in 93. I'd always been interested, when I was doing my master's in politics, which was on a thing called Prestel, which was a precursor to the internet. It was going to become the universal database. So I was very interested and very excited to hear Tim talking about open source, because that's what I'm studying now. A lot of people talk about the hacker's ethic that basically sits behind the internet. The whole thing, Apache, that runs the servers, is free open source software. There is, in the hacker's ethic, freedom, knowledge wants to be free. So I was very interested, how were they going to do the universal database? The British Post Office at the time, this is before our country even deregulated telecommunications, in 1984 they were talking about, we'll charge them for it. Well, of course, no one wanted to pay. The French, meanwhile, got on with it with a thing called Minitel, and what they discovered long before Facebook and MySpace and Bebo was that people were more interested in the social network. They wanted to discover how, you know, other people, talk to people from other places, find common purpose. So that was kind of my background. I then read a really cool book in 93 by a guy called Howard Rheingold on virtual reality. And I realised that I'd really left my play too late to be a filmmaker, to be honest. He, in 93, on the front cover it had a quote from Arthur C. Clarke, who just died recently, a great scientist and science fiction writer. He wrote that VR would eat TV alive. And I thought, well, that sounds pretty cool. I'd get involved with that. Since then, VR has come a long way. It's been going for a long time. A lot of people think that even the concept of the virtual is very recent. But in fact, it goes back to 2,000 years. The history of immersive art goes back to, in Pompeii. Let me just see if I can bring up this picture here. In Pompeii, this was the Villa Domitii, and around 60 BC. Now, and this is what happens when you've got technology. Is it going to jump through? Okay, we'll see if we can pause it. I built this on a DVD because I didn't trust PowerPoint, and it just shows you. It was good to hear Brenda talking about Neuromancer. We've jumped forward to 1984. Gibson termed the term cyberspace, and it was said in a virtual world. We're now at the time. I looked at. I took a proposal to Saatchi and Saatchi Worldwide around 2000, just coming up to before September 11, when everyone was gung-ho and people were looking at all sorts of interesting ideas. What we proposed then were going to be a network of virtual reality theatres. So what Silicon Graphics devised, Silicon Graphics, that was started by Jim Clark, the inventor of the 3D chip, they were heavily into virtual reality. Now, they were doing uncool things like testing military explosions and things like that, using VR to really immerse themselves in the data. There were people also doing stuff in oil and gas, where you've got terabytes of information and you can't intuitively understand it. Then there were people in aerospace who were doing amazing flight simulators. So these reality centres, they called them, were 3 metres high, so about this height, but they were in a 150-degree curved screen. It ran on a thumping great Onyx supercomputer, which is pretty daunting to look at. And it cost you around $3 million to get. You also wore immersive glasses. So what it enabled you to do was to have a number of people all in the same virtual experience together. Most people think of virtual reality like this guy here, where it's just a closed world and you're in this world by yourself. We've moved a long way from since then. Now we're looking at when Second Life came along. I thought, wow, this is amazing. You can have concurrent users of up to 60,000 people now, all in this one world, all around the planet. They have millions of people who are signed up to this. The Gartner Group, who are a technology consultancy, have predicted that by 2011, we are looking at 80% of all internet users will have a presence in a virtual world. So that means that there are all sorts of career possibilities. I'm a failed scientist. I went to my stage one BSc was spent at the Kiwi. I basically drank my way through my first year at university and decided that it wasn't really me. I think the thing is that now, with the possibility of what science can do and what you can do as an engineer, both in computing, but also things like quantum physics. I started out with time travel as a bit facetious, but let me show you. I came across this on the fabulous YouTube. It's just going to take me right through this. This, by the way, this just here is kind of interesting. We'll go back to that. Of course, you can't go back. You can only go forward. Moore's Law, we're racing through it. We're seeing it all. That screen I tried to stop at was one of the first virtual worlds. It was called a MUD, which was a multi-user dungeon or multi-user domain. And basically, it was a virtual world in your mind because it was all text-based. We've come a long way since then. We're now looking at, within the next 10 years, a fully immersive world where it will look very photorealistic and it will be difficult to differentiate. What I'm showing you here, just before that, you might have seen the classic curve. Who's heard of Moore's Law? Okay. Moore's Law basically says that every 24 months, and now it's been revised. Gordon Moore worked for Intel, and back in the 60s, he came up with this thing, Moore's Law. Every 24 months, the number of transistors on a CPU will double and the price will stay the same. Now, that has stayed true since the 60s, and in fact, people like Ray Kurzweil have gone back and looked at a number of technologies, and it actually stays true almost from the beginning of time in terms of technology. What we are on is we're going into what they call the double exponential growth. So we're at the very interesting part. We're in the best time possible to be alive because we are going to see things that you just will not believe. What is already here is, William Gibson said, the future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed. So if you look around you, you will find stuff that you will think that's unbelievable. Some interesting implications of Moore's Law are that It's estimated by 2010 that we'll be looking at a supercomputer with the same processing power as the human brain. Now, there are more neurons in the human brain than there are stars up there. The complexity of the human brain is unbelievable, but we are going to see that. They're already well on their way to achieving that by 2011. Between 2015 and 2020, we're going to see human consciousness starting to evolve in computing. So this is the opinion of British Telecom's futurist, and a lot of very smart people are looking at this space. They're calling it the singularity. I'm teaching a class at Victoria in digital design and industrial design students, where our challenge is actually to devise a product or a service for Vodafone 80 years into the future. So the singularity is a mathematical concept which basically says if we go up this way, we'll see the curve of exponential change. Say this was 2008 and this is about 2010. We're just starting to see a big curve like that. So if you think it's been fast up till now, you haven't seen anything yet. What the implications of that are is that by 2023, that according to Moore's law, we will be looking at a computer with the same capacity or capability as the human brain for $1,000. By 2037, that will cost you 1 cent, that capability. By 2049... it will cost you $1,000 to have that sort of processing, the same processing capability as the entire human race. And by 2059, that will cost you 1 cent. So if you think you know what you're going to be doing then, I'd be very intrigued to hear what you have to say. I think in terms of careers, what everybody has said today is absolutely right. You need to be lateral thinkers. It needs to be life education. I've gone back to school. I'm doing a PhD now because I realise my industry, the film industry, has changed radically. It's 100 years old, for goodness sake. It's over the hill. You know, it's gone. What's going to happen when in the 2030 we'll be looking at nanotechnology particles? They talk about this idea of a utility fog, and this may sound like science fiction, but the American military, scary enough, are looking at these what they call foglets or utility fogs right now. What they are flying nanobots. They might be in this room. They fly around. You won't be able to see them because they're smaller as an atom, flying around, and they can basically have a distributed artificial intelligence that can pull these utility fogs all together to materialise this screen, myself, so that you actually, why have a screen when you can communicate via that? The idea of just communication, for example, this is a new headgear, very geeky. That headgear is made by a company called Emotive. And Emotive, that's a robot on the left. Emotive, let me show you this.
lets you play without moving your hands. It's all about mind control. A new startup company is launching the technology this week at a gaming conference. Don Clark is the deputy bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal. He's written about these new kind of video games. So how does it work? So I put on this headgear, right? And then what actually happens? How does this EEG technology work if I can wear some goofy headgear?
Yeah, it sounds like Yoda and use the force loop, doesn't it? It's based on EEG technology, the same kind of thing they've been scanning brains for years with. And this company, Emotive, is going to sell a little headset, and they have to get the video game makers to adapt their software to use it. But basically, it reads your brainwaves, and it can do quite interesting little simple tasks. It's not a replacement for the joystick, but it could have some interesting possibilities.
Now, from what I've read, a player has to actually sort of train their mind to be able to play with this system. Explain to me what they need to do.
That's right. Basically, you have to envision a task, say, picking up an object, and it's a very specified task, and then you try to imagine it, and then you keep telling the software over and over again that thought you're having equals that task, so you kind of train it over time. I haven't done it.
So you get the idea. There's actually another clip on YouTube that actually shows him flying a little remote control flying saucer using mind control. I mean, it sounds pretty weird. Arthur C. Clarke said that any advanced technology will seem like magic, and that is the realm that we're going into. Obviously, in terms of entertainment and things like that, how many of you are gamers? Excellent. The good news about gaming is it's not bad for your brain. It's there's now quite a lot of research showing how good it is in terms of developing your mind. Obviously, developing your reactions, and some of the myths. I mean, I'm talking to the converted here, obviously, but one of the myths of gaming is that it's antisocial, that you put on weight and you sit behind it and you drink a lot of highly caffeinated liquid. That you may still drink a lot of Coke, but that's another issue. The thing is that we're moving into a very social sort of environment with these, such as World of Warcraft and Second Life, and these are actually becoming serious business skills, because what computers can't really do, and this is the whole thing about developing the right hemisphere part of your brain, your creative side. The artificial intelligence that's on its way, that they predict will be capable of winning the Nobel Prize by 2020, that artificial intelligence won't be able to do, still can't do, the creative side as well as we can. Eventually, it will be approaching it. So what you have to do is you have to be able to be a knowledge gatherer of diverse bits of information. So get as much life experience as possible. Learn, take interest in science as well as the arts. Take interest in history, because in history there is so much that we already know about ourselves, so much that is already there. Grand Theft Auto, this is why the film industry is under threat. $100 million budget for Grand Theft Auto. It romped off the shelves. And any of you guys got it? few Grand Theft. So, I mean, there's a lot of things about how it's going to turn you into violent individuals. Well, I think one of the first immersive things that came out was the book, and there is hell and damnation in that book, the Bible. So I think it hasn't really corrupted too many people, although, of course, the Romans took to it quite well. This is when gaming and the virtual coincide or converge. This is CSI, and I don't know if anyone saw this. This was on TV the other night. Sorry about the aspect ratio and the quality. CSI and Second Life. Interestingly enough, CBS, who runs CSI, bought a percentage of a company called Electric Sheep, who are a consultancy to Virtual Worlds for $7 million. The media plays in the virtual world space are becoming huge. I don't know if you've heard of Club Penguin. These are the people that are coming up behind you. The 10-year-olds now are playing Club Penguin, and it's estimated that there'll be 30 million kids in Club Penguin. Club Penguin is a 2.5D world, and this is what we're basically learning to do. I taught last year in Second Life, so I would be based in Auckland, and my students would meet me in Second Life on the island media called Media Zone. Victoria University showed enough vision to agree to allow me to buy an island to teach the students. We taught a thing called Machinima, which if you're gamers, you've probably heard of Machinima. It's basically machine cinema or virtual movie making, using the gaming engine to create movies. Now, it's very popular on YouTube. You see it all the time. In Second Life, you get to do things that only Peter Jackson could have dreamed of. To create a track. You know, traditionally, you end up with 200 people on the crew to make a film normally. To run a track, which you put what they call a dolly on, which is a very expensive piece of technology with a crane. And if we wanted, say, a tracking shot of you coming down here, we would lay it down here. And one of the reasons that filmmaking is so expensive, you typically shoot 2 to 3 minutes a day, if you're lucky, of the film. So that one shot, you'd set it up there, you'd probably have the key grip, all the lighting, the camera operator, and it would take you probably two hours to set up just that one shot to do something that you'd probably only used maybe 5 seconds of. Now, in Second Life, with a virtual camera attached to me, I can walk around this room and I get these little yellow balls popping up behind me, and it lays a virtual track. I can then say, you will follow this track, and the camera will move. And you can do these very difficult shots, dropping down from the ceiling, moving around. So the whole aspect of filmmaking is very interesting once you take it into a virtual world. Obviously, you've got virtual actors, et cetera, et cetera. Artificial intelligence has already started to appear in Second Life. They've got... there's a artificial intelligence for a dog. So they've got this little avatar of a dog, and you train this dog. You say sit, and he doesn't get it. And you say no. If he stood on his hind legs, you'd say no, sit. So you train the artificial intelligence of this dock. They reckon now that the AI is sufficiently advanced to a four-year-old's capability based on psychological tests of four-year-olds. So you'll see in virtual worlds, they're finding it a great training ground for both economists, teachers, computer scientists. And one of the reasons that IBM have 50 islands in Second Life is because they're finding it is great for meeting all around the world. We could bring you all together into one space where you could actually be sending me information. So it's basically globalization has meant that the offices in real offices are becoming dispersed. Sun Microsystems, they find at any one time only 50% of their workers are actually ever in the office. So you've got challenges in terms of people feeling alienated and, you know, not getting together with their friends anymore, not having Friday night drinks. So they're looking to virtual worlds to try and solve that problem. I was going to show... Let's see if our friends have been logged off, of course. I'll see if I can log on. I'm also this weekend. I'm down for a conference on commercializing ideas, and so I was very interested to hear about Tim's company. I think that's very exciting that we now have the possibility. It's being recognized that we have the possibility of running open source companies and making a living out of it. They estimate in the last year that the business deals involving open source companies have been sold for $30 billion. So likes of Google are now have bought MySQL, the database, for $1 billion. So there's some very interesting aspects around knowledge exchange and creative collaboration there. This is just a little promo. It won't mean anything to you, but of some stuff that I shot for this conference using Second Life. So basically, I've got a team of people together, and we're looking at how knowledge is... they talk about the knowledge economy, but most people still think in terms of Newtonian physics, in terms of bricks and mortar. We're now in the world of bits and bytes, where it's no cost to replicate information. So it has huge implications in terms of who you work with, what you share ideas, who you share ideas with. I would encourage you to look into those areas and look into areas of knowledge sharing and creative collaboration. So that was a bit of a ramble, but that's probably all I need to say right now. So thank you for your time.
Well, big thanks to Pete for giving us a window into his world, and what a cool world he has.